So last week we were looking at Paul before Felix. Felix is now no longer governor of Judea. He's been taken over by, it's been taken over by Festus, who's a different sort of animal. He's a much more reasonable man than Felix. 3 days after Festus arrived in Caesarea to take over his new responsibilities, he left for Jerusalem, where the leading priests and other Jewish leaders met with him and made their accusations against Paul. They asked Festus as a favor to transfer Paul to Jerusalem, planning to ambush him and kill him on the way. But Festus replied that Paul was at Caesarea, and he himself would be returning there soon. So he said, "Those of you in authority can return with me. If Paul has done anything wrong, you can make your accusations." About 8 or 10 days later, Festus returned to Caesarea, and on the following day, he took his seat in the court and ordered that Paul be brought in. When Paul arrived, the Jewish leaders from Jerusalem gathered around and made many serious accusations they could not prove. Paul denied the charges. "I'm not guilty of any crime against the Jewish laws or the temple or the Roman government," he said. Then Festus, wanting to please the Jews, asked him, "Are you willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there?" But Paul replied, "No, this is the official Roman court, so I ought to be tried right here. You know very well I'm not guilty of harming the Jews. If I've done something worthy of death, I don't refuse to die. But if I'm innocent, no one has a right to turn me over to these men to kill me. I appeal to Caesar." Festus conferred with his advisors and then replied, "Very well, you have appealed to Caesar, and to Caesar you will go." A few days later, King Agrippa arrived with his sister Bernice to pay their respects to Festus. During the stay of several days, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. "There's a prisoner here," he told him, "whose case was left for me by Felix. When I was in Jerusalem, the leading priests and Jewish elders pressed charges against him and asked me to condemn him. I pointed out to them that Roman law does not convict people without a trial. They must be given an opportunity to confront their accusers and defend themselves. When his accusers came here for the trial, I didn't delay. I called the case the very next day and ordered Paul to be brought in. But the accusations made against him weren't any of the crimes I expected. Instead, it was something about their religion and a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul insists is alive. I was at a loss to know how to investigate these things, so I asked him whether he would be willing to stand trial on these charges in Jerusalem. But Paul appealed to have his case decided by the emperor, so I ordered that he held in custody until I could arrange to send him to Caesar." "I'd like to hear the man myself," Agrippa said. And Festus replied, "You will tomorrow." So the next day, Agrippa and Bernice arrived at the auditorium with great pomp, accompanied by military officers and prominent men of the city. Festus ordered that Paul be brought in. And then Festus said, "King Agrippa and all who are here, this is the man whose death is demanded by all the Jews, both here and in Jerusalem. But in my opinion, he's done nothing deserving death. However, since he appealed his case to the emperor, I have decided to send him to Rome. But what shall I write to the emperor? For there is no clear charge against him. So I brought him before all of you, especially you, King Agrippa, so that after we examine him, I might have something to write. For it makes no sense to send a prisoner to the emperor without specifying the charges against him." Okay. So last week we looked at the account of Paul before Felix. Remember, Felix was a very unjust ruler in Judea, and indeed he kept Paul in prison mostly because he wanted to see if he could get a bribe out of Paul for his release. That was last week, and we spoke about the task of every Christian to speak the truth to power with respect, with grace, but with boldness as well, and that we all have that opportunity in our lives. Now we move to Paul before Festus. And this is a coin minted for the reign of Porcius Festus. According to the Roman historian Josephus, he was a much fairer man. He still suppressed Jewish rebellion very firmly, but he wasn't known for the sort of corruption that Felix had got up to. Although Festus himself, well, he's facing a quandary here. We also hear in this story about Agrippa II. Agrippa II is the fifth of the Herodian kings and the last of them. The first of them being the Herod the Great, who was around at the time of Jesus' birth. The way of the exile. The way of the exile. How did you find that video? Was that a challenging video? If you are listening on the podcast, I'd recommend that you pause just now and you go and watch the Bible Project's video called The Way of the Exile. There's another Bible Project video called Exile that's equally brilliant but different. The Way of the Exile. It's a discussion of the theme of what it means to live in the world. Anyone ever find that challenging? Show of hands, you know, it'll encourage the person sitting by you. Can it be tough sometimes? Really, really tough. And when we live in the world, we face all sorts of challenges, do we not? Some things in our world we think, well, that looks very much like the sort of thing that Jesus would be doing. The Spirit of God's at work in the organizations and the communities and the family groups that we live in, and that's great, isn't it? It's a wonderful thing. And it's easy to relax back into that. But then every now and then we're brought down with a bump when we realize that things are not as they should be in this world. So what I want to talk to you about today is to go back over the story of Paul's recent, since Paul arrived in Jerusalem. Now remember, Paul arrived in Jerusalem having had a word from the prophet Agabus, who actually was living in Caesarea. So Paul's incarceration in Caesarea for two years or so meant that he was still in contact with that church community very much so. But Agabus had done a kind of prophetic drama with him and taken Paul's belt and tied his hands and then says rather cryptically, the one who owns this belt will be bound like this, accused by the Jews, and then seized by the Romans. It's easy to see at that point, from a human perspective, that things start going wrong. Yes? What sort of things has Paul been doing on his missionary trips? Have they been fruitful? There's all sorts of wee churches and some not so wee churches appearing all around the Mediterranean. The parish I have responsibility for stretches out to Murfoot Farm that way and just up to just beyond Moss End that way, Butlerfield that way, and Birkenside. That's over the edge. A bit of Birkenside's over the edge. That's in Borthwick Parish. So that's the extent of the parish I have responsibility for. Paul had a responsibility for a massive area all through Western Asia and Asia Minor, all through across to Greece and down through Macedonia into the south of Greece, on the islands. There's a colossal coverage. Those of you who've been here a long time may remember that we had a Korean Methodist called Joshua Paul. And Joshua Paul was once the Korean Methodist Church missionary to Russia. How do you make what I'm doing on Monday when you've got a responsibility for the whole of Russia? Well, what you do is you find people who are willing to respond to the gospel and you work with them and you build with them and you just keep at it. Paul was a man with those kind of responsibilities. So he's done two kind of tours of duty. He's now been falsely accused of desecrating the temple in Jerusalem, and he's been in prison now for 2 years. How does that look from a human standpoint? Does it look good? You see, from a human standpoint, I think there's a timeline which looks like this. Well, let me explain what I mean by two timelines, shall I? Every life lived in this world is a story of two timelines. The first timeline is a human story. You with me? It's the sort of thing that we tell at a funeral. Key things that have happened in somebody's life. And the second timeline is God's story. What that human story looks like from God's perspective. I suppose the first thing I need to do is to convince you that there's a difference. Every now and then I dip into the folk religion because I come across it every now and then. The folk religion is what people generally believe to be true, whether it's true or not, about, you know, faith, God, stuff like that. Here's one. What's for you'll no go by you. What's for you'll no go by you. Hands up here if having lived a life with Jesus Christ, you think that that is absolutely true. Okay. Hands up if you think it's false. Hands up if you're waiting to see what I said before you committed yourself, because you don't want to appear like a wee dafty. There we go. Okay. So, what's for you'll no go by you is a way of saying that every single thing that happens on this earth is foreordained by a higher power. I do not believe that's true. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. Let's take someone like prostate cancer, shall we? Do you imagine in the heavenly court, there's a certain number of prostate cancers to hand out that day? Okay, and then a debate starts in the heavenly court as to who's going to get prostate cancer. The shallow end, you know, maybe a bit of chemo, they'll be all right. Or they're gonna die of someone else before it catches up with them because, you know. At the other end, really bad prostate cancer. Are you with me? How absurd does this sound? Do you think the heavenly court is picking people? It's bizarre, isn't it? But that's a consequence of what's for you'll no go by you. And those of you who've been through the difficulties of that sort of an illness will know how tough that is. And that's, I don't believe that for a moment. Did God make the world? Yes. Did he make it good? Yes. Is everything as intended? No. Why? Because there's been a fall. Why was there a fall? Well, apparently we were implicated in it, but we're not the only source of the fall. There was apparently a rebellion in the heavenly realm too. We don't know enormous amounts about it, but Genesis 6 seems to indicate that there was a huge rebellion, and we read about it in places like Ezekiel 28, and we read about it in, let's see, it's Revelation 12, isn't it, where the dragon sweeps the stars out. I mean, you can go around the Bible and find text. It's not the most important thing. The important thing to know is that this world is not as intended. So things can happen in this world that are not good. Not good. I believe in a Jesus who believes that cancer is evil. I believe in a Jesus who believes that child abuse is evil, that dictators are evil, that the kind of internecine warfare in families and in governments and stuff is evil. Do I have anybody with me on that? Yes. If that's true, then what's for you'll no go by you is only at best proverbially true most of the time. And even then, I'm unsure about it. That's actually karma. What's for you'll no go by you. That's what that is. So if there's any of those sort of thoughts in your mind, what you've done is you've taken the human story and God's story and squished them together to make one. So that there aren't two timelines, there's only one timeline. Extreme Scottish Calvinists suffer from this. Okay? Has anybody ever come across a dour Presbyterian? Is that laughter at the lunacy of such a thought? Or have you actually met a dour Scots Presbyterian? Right. Why do you think Scots Presbyterians were so dour? Because they were fed such a predestinarian concept of God's work in the world that they were almost immune to the truth of grace. Now, Sunny comes into my kitchen one day and she says, I need you to know, Pastor Mark, she's very respectful, I need you to know, Pastor Mark, I believe in the sovereign will of God. And I thought, ooh, how am I going to deal with this? Because that's a predestinarian statement. And I said, Sunny, I am delighted that God has given you the free will to do so. And sometimes people talk to me and they say, well, it's all down to us and it's all about our free will. And then I find myself leaning on the predestinarian side that actually, well, I think God has a plan and a purpose for your life. But the plan is not tyrannical, and the free will is not absolute. For those of you who are listening to Jordan Peterson last Sunday night, there needs to be a balance between the order and chaos in our theology. Not too rigid a structure of predestination, not too loose a structure in free will. You know, the chorus, I have decided to follow Jesus, okay? I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, has angelic subtitles. I've decided to follow Jesus because we gave you a nudge. I decided to follow Jesus because of God's grace at work in your life before you knew him. No turning back by God's grace. So if wherever you find yourself on that seesaw, I think it's God's intention that we have a reasonable balance of both. Because both are in the scriptures. Jesus, he expounds both. He is neither radical free will and God's discovering things as he's going along, nor is he, God has foreordained the fact that you're going to fall down the stairs next Tuesday, and when you do so, the godly thing to do would be to brush yourself off and say, thank God I got that over and done with. So, there's two timelines. The human story, two timelines. The human story. Paul's human story is that he was working his way around, planting churches, encouraging churches, networking leaders. You see that at those lists at the end that you're tempted to skip over, but which actually are a record of the people that Paul is thankful for, the people who are helping support church networks in homes, by and large, all over the Roman Empire around that eastern end of the Mediterranean. And Paul has big plans, as you know from the time we spent in Romans last year, to take that mission all the way to Spain that way and over into Asia that way. And so now Paul finds himself lacking the freedom to move. He's now a prisoner. Has he been rightly accused? No. As we say last week, he finds himself in a parallel of the story of Jesus' accusation in front of the religious authorities who condemn him, in front of the civil authorities who are kind of scratching their head but don't want a rebellion. But the human story from Paul's point of view is now challenging. Is it much fun being a prisoner? I mean, has anybody been held by customs for a couple of hours or immigration? How much fun was that? Not fun at all. Not fun at all, absolutely. U.S. immigration held Walter Hunter for 3 years. Now, some of you know Walter Hunter. Who's the least likely person to be masterminding an international network of terrorists? So being a prisoner is no fun. He is now not free to conduct his mission. He has ambitions such as taking the gospel to Spain, which are now looking very unlikely. And for all those people who are hoping that Paul would continue his efforts, I mean, if I was in somewhere like Galatia or Corinth, if I was in Colossae or in Rome, I would just be itching in Ephesus. I mean, you hear that time and again in his letters that he says, I'm sorry I haven't got to you. I'm trying to get to you. Why? Because how encouraging is it when you get a leader, a substantial, God-fearing leader in your midst? Isn't it brilliant? The only church at the moment that's going, is the church in Caesarea, because they've gotten captive. So it looks like Paul's best plans are now not going to come to fruition. And if we take a step back, we're going to learn that, yeah, he does go to Caesar, he does end up in Rome, and then in Nero's persecutions, Paul is right where Nero needs him to be. Because Nero, who was, I mean, the man was a maniac. He really was. Vents his frustration on the Christians, and then sees an opportunity to remodel a bit of Rome, has it burnt down, blames it on the Christians. In a sort of nasty poetic mirroring, he sets Christians on fire in his gardens for his garden parties, sends them to the lions, all this sort of stuff. And guess where Paul is? One of the most important leaders of this Jesus movement is right there in Rome under house arrest. So what does Nero do? According to church history, he has him beheaded. 65 AD or so. Does that sound like a good end? Is that the end you'd have written for Paul? No. Let's have a look at the God story now, shall we? We've had a look at the human story. Let's have a look at the God story. Has the Lord warned Paul that he's about to become a prisoner? Yes. And why is it, do you think, that God has allowed Paul to become a prisoner? There's a possibility that if Paul had leant on the justice of Festus, that actually, even though there was a plot to assassinate him on the way to Jerusalem, that Festus would have released him. But what does Paul do that makes that impossible? He appeals to Caesar. He says, I am a Roman citizen, I appeal to Caesar. And of course, famously, Festus says, you have appealed to Caesar, to Caesar you will go. Paul is now going to be taken to Rome. Hang on a minute, press the pause button. Festus, Porcius Festus, the Roman governor of Judea, says to King Herod Agrippa II and his sister Bernice, we've got this guy that Felix left for us. There's some dispute about theology or whatever. And he believes that this dead person, Jesus, is alive. So who's now proclaiming the good news of Jesus' resurrection to King Agrippa? Festus is. Why is that? Because Festus doesn't know much about the Jews. Felix knew more because he was married to a Jew. Remember, he tempted his missus away from another king, and she was a Jew. So now, after telling Felix and wife and Festus, he's now got the opportunity, and Ross will go into this tonight, to speak about the gospel to the king of the Jews. This is the fifth of the Herodian kings who had to themselves the title King of the Jews. They were vassal rulers under Rome, but they were allowed to call themselves King of the Jews. Does that ring any bells? Who else was called King of the Jews? Because of Pilate's mockery. It was absolutely fascinating. You start to see all this stuff slot together. So here's the God story. Paul, is Paul a reasonably good communicator of the gospel? Yeah, he's up there, isn't he? He's up there. We'd let him lead an evangelism course in our church, wouldn't we? Why not? Because he seems to be remarkably good at it. So you'd have Paul leading your evangelism course. You'd have Paul doing that. Now he's speaking the truth to power, but he's not only speaking the truth to power, he's communicating the gospel to people in power. The news about this tiny little sect of Judaism that is now beginning to spread through the Jewish population, which is not insignificant, but it's certainly not a majority, that's starting to make its way through the Roman Empire. People are starting to hear about the name of Jesus. And that's the God story. You see, the thing is about the way of exile that was being presented there, is that this is the way that God communicates to communities, to power structures, to groups and families and ethnic tribes or whatever, the truth of the gospel. I want to introduce you to someone who you may know. This is Asia Bibi. Asia Bibi has been in prison for 10 years. She's just been released. Does anybody know about the story of Asia Bibi? Can I just check? Right, I'll fill in those of you who don't. One day, Asia and her neighbors were picking fruit. She washed her hands in a bucket of water, and the other women complained that her washing her hands in the bucket of water now made that water unclean for them to use as Muslims. And they said, you should convert to Islam, and then we can share, you know, a bucket, it'll make life much easier for you. Asia then says, no, But the women who were talking to her took that as an affront against the prophet Muhammad and reported her to the local court for blasphemy, which carries in Pakistan a possible sentence of death. And so the local court imprisons Asia Bibi. This is a mother with two daughters and a husband at home. Well, this is obviously a miscarriage of justice. But the government of Pakistan know that to have Asia Bibi executed because people made a lot of noise about it, be it Open Doors or the Barnabas Trust or Amnesty International, international news, thank goodness for a free press. And so we got to know about Asia Bibi's plight. And over the years, there have been various attempts. She was sentenced to death, by the way, but the death sentence was not carried out. But there's absolutely no doubt that the authorities in Lahore knew that there would be trouble if they went through with the execution. And so she was imprisoned for 10 years wrongfully. Finally, the case got to the Supreme Court. And last week, I think it was, Asia Bibi was released from prison and the charges were dropped based on the flimsy evidence that she had done anything that warranted any charge whatsoever. And radical Islamic parties in Pakistan brought people out on the street calling for her death. Asia Bibi is now the subject of a compromise from the Pakistani authorities. The Pakistani authorities have said that if you stop protesting and calling for her death, we will forbid Asia Bibi to leave the country. Oops. The one thing that she and her family need to do, indeed her lawyer, the lawyer who represented her at the Supreme Court, has already fled the country for fear of his life. Somewhere south of Cairo, some Coptic Christians were on a pilgrimage and their bus was blown up. Seven of them are being buried, pretty much as we speak. Somewhere in China, another church will be pulled down or its cross will be taken off. Recently, a church was demolished by the Chinese authorities and they had the temerity to hand the $130,000 bill to the church. And don't just think it's Christians. In the north of China, hundreds of thousands of Muslims have been put in internment camps to re-educate them. And the only way we know where these camps are is because there are various satellites that fly over the area, and we've seen the building of the camps. It's a very dangerous place to go and try and film. But we know from people who've lost contact with relatives in the UK that there are Muslims being persecuted there. Indeed, in India, a Sikh was arrested the night of his wedding for no particular reason by radical Hindus in an administration in India. There are real problems living in the world. So how do we respond to that? How do we respond to that? Tim Mackey in the Bible Project video suggested that Jeremiah was saying to the Jewish people who are about to be carried into exile by the Babylonians after their defeat by the Babylonians in 587 BC and the sacking of Jerusalem a year later, which include the burning of Solomon's temple and the looting of it. What Jeremiah said is that there's an alternative to outright rebellion or compliance. And that is this mix of loyalty and subversion. Loyalty and subversion. Asia Bibi, in refusing to deny that Jesus is the Messiah and that he's risen from the dead, was subversive. Even though she was a good citizen, even though she was, you know, she was not the leader of any radical movement other than one of faith, this is something that we must learn. Loyalty and subversion. When there's persecution, it's easier to see. But when we live in relatively peaceable times, it's harder to tease things out. So in Asya Bibi's story, there are two timelines. The first one is that a mother of two has been taken away from her daughters for 10 years and imprisoned, which is a horror. She has done so unjustly. And now, even though she has been freed, her freedoms are threatened by the government giving way to Islamic radicals. That's what it looks like from a human point of view. It looks pretty desperate, doesn't it? You would not want to be in her shoes. What about from God's perspective? 1.6% of the Pakistani population are Christians. They have been sorely persecuted. You may remember an Easter Sunday in recent years. Some people thought it might be an idea to roll grenades into the worship. From a human perspective, these stories look desperate. From God's perspective, these stories look different, because what they are doing is holding out for the name of Jesus where it's tough, where they are forced to deny the love of Jesus. They stand firm. But all the rest of the time, they are good citizens in the countries that they are living in. And that is a real different third way to living in the world. We can rant and rave against the world as it stands and become part of all sorts of action movements and speak disrespectfully. You know, it's not that there's anything wrong with that, with movements necessarily. But the default position of a Christian living in the world is to work with the authorities that are there, even if they are corrupt. But when a compromise of faith or principle comes up, of value, that we stand firm. That we stand firm. And I'm sure all of us can think of people who did precisely that. Because as Jesus followers, we live with these two timelines simultaneously. And we never know when we're going to face our situation in our family, in our work, whatever it may be. And it helps to know that when we face the challenges of this world, we are, in John Stott's paraphrase of Jesus' prayer in John 17, in the world but not of the world. We're here, but we are citizens of a greater kingdom. And as we approach the challenges in our lives, we need to imagine that there's two timelines. And sometimes as human beings, it's much easier to read the timeline. I lost my job. I lost my health. This person who was dear to me died. Someone got really sick really fast. I don't know what it is, but my mood is unstable or low. This unjust thing has happened to me. Things are not working out as planned. I worked very hard to get qualifications, and now I can't find work. I'm trying to work it with my family, but I keep getting knocked back. All these kind of things. These are normal experiences for people in the world. We all face difficulty and injustice and sorrow and pain. But here's the thing, that is not the predominant view of our lives. Paul wrote this line, all things work together for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Where did he write that letter? From prison. Are you hearing me? Paul took the restriction that he couldn't move and realized he had another time to reflect and to write and to work through his understanding of who the resurrected Jesus was. There are entire tracts of the New Testament that would not be available to us had Paul not been incarcerated unjustly. Do you hear me? There are things in your life that you will be incapable of doing unless God can, by some gracious way, work through the suffering that he did not directly intend for you. Do you understand? That as we face challenges and difficulties, sorrows and pains, God has a perspective on how those horrible and life-harming events can become part of his story of grace in a world in need. Amen? Now, why might that be? Why might it be important to see our lives from God's perspective? Well, first, it will stop us getting stuck in our suffering. But secondly is this, It is an extension of our understanding of the story of who. The foundational story of our lives is the story of Jesus. And while we get the privilege of jumping to the resurrection and the glorification and the beginning of the new creation, the new heaven and earth that we'll be caught up in, and praise God, souls, every person that I've loved who loves him who's gone before me. But he went through human life, growing up, watching his father die, watching the brutality of the Romans in the nearby city of Sepphoris. He grew up in Nazareth. It's funny, we never hear about Sepphoris in the New Testament. Sepphoris was enormous, new city where Jesus would have built stuff. We heard about Nazareth because that's where he came from. He lived amongst sinful, broken people. He went to funerals. He was understanding of the plight that we face. But it came to him that the Spirit of Yahweh dwelt in him, that there was something that was different about him. And so Jesus works through all the suffering and difficulty of the world, witnesses it, alleviates it in healing, but everybody he healed died again. Everybody he resurrected died again. Then he goes to Gethsemane, and he takes the whole lot. Who here knows that Jesus took possession of your sin when you became a Christian? Yeah, did he? Okay. Cool. Who here knows that the devil's back was broken on the cross? Yeah? I hope so. I hope you just got tired arms. Who here knows that Jesus took possession of our suffering at Gethsemane? Our suffering. Our suffering is no longer our possession because he has offered to take it from us and bear it with us. That's the way of the cross. And if you don't believe me, before Jesus was executed, he said these words to his followers: if you're going to come and follow after me, you must take up your cross daily. And that does not hit us anything like as hard as it should. He might as well said, you might as well, every day you follow after me, tie your own noose. That's what Jesus did for us.